Okay, Parshas Vayishlach gives us quite a bit to talk about. So we'll do the best we can to try, even with our focus on one aliyah, to address some of what can be found in this very, very intense Parsha, which says a lot, and there's a lot that's unsaid. There's a lot that's between the lines, and we'll try to call attention to as much as we can in the time that we have. So here we have Yaakov preparing for his confrontation with Esav. And there's much here in this aliyah that we'll see will give us an opportunity to reflect upon the first aliyah. But here we're in the middle of this process. And the aliyah tells us, begins with Pasuk Yidalid, Vayolan Sham Balai Lahu, Vayikach Min Habov Yado, Mincha Esav Achiv. So he slept there that night. And there is a interesting observation in the Sefer Azayim LaTorah of the Lutzgerel, especially if you consider the fact that he's preparing for war as well. So it's interesting that he slept at night instead of confronting them then, because it would be more of a surprise to attack at night. And yet, he doesn't do that because, as we know from Chazal's comments on the previous aliyah that Rashi quotes, that he was afraid of killing anyone, and therefore he wanted to make sure he didn't make any mistakes, so he didn't want to get involved in the conflict at night. And it brings up that point that comes up in the first aliyah when the pasuk says that Yira Yaakov Ma'od VaYetzerlo, he was very afraid and he was anxiety ridden. And Chazal tell us, Gemara in Brachos, that Rashi quotes that he was worried both in terms of himself, but he was also, the double language is to convey to us that he was worried that he would die, but he was also worried that he might kill somebody else. And there is a discussion some of the Svarim have. I have to confess, I never really fully understood the question, even though you can find it already among the Rishonim. They ask, why was he so afraid of killing someone else? If a person is Rodef you, so you're permitted to kill a Rodef. So why should he be so afraid of that? So I found that question very difficult to understand, and I still don't know if I really understand it. It would seem clear that as much as there is a heter to kill a rodef if necessary, but certainly you want to do everything possible to avoid it. So the idea that he would be afraid that that would happen, even if it would be 100% justified, certainly makes sense to us. I'm not sure why that question really needs to be asked, in addition to the fact that some of the Svarim point out, and comes up in other contexts as well, that there always has to be an evaluation that even in Timtzil Omer, yes, it's true that one is permitted to kill a Rodef, but one also has to make the correct assessment as to who exactly is guilty of that and who isn't. And the possibility of making a mistake is always present, which is part of what this pasuk is highlighting. So the question is hard to understand on two levels, at least. You know, first of all, that you may make a misassessment and a misjudgment, and even if your judgment is 100% correct, you certainly want to do everything possible to not be in that situation. So don't totally understand the question, but here this comment emphasizes that point, that because he was really being very careful not to have any unnecessary loss of life on either side, so therefore he didn't come and confront them at night. So here the pasuk continues, Vayikach min habav yado mincha la'esav achiv. So he took some of that which he had, he sent it as a gift to Esav, his brother. So the psukim are going to detail, the next few psukim after this, are going to detail all the different animals that he took. And here, before it goes into that detail, so this pasuk tells us, habav yado. And Rashi tells us what that means, Avonin Tobos Margolios, Shadam Tzor B'tzor, V'nosim B'yado. So it refers to jewelry, refers to special precious stones that he had. That was part of what he took. And it's interesting, some point out, in the Sefer Minchas Aharon, contemporary Sefer on Chumash, he notes that it seems a little interesting that people kind of like diamonds, and you would think that would get a little bit more attention. And yet, psukim after this go into great detail about all the animals, And the diamonds were only told Beremiza. It's not even identified at all in the Pasuk. We're only supposed to figure out that that's what Min Haba Biyodo is referring to. So he suggests that the Pasuk is emphasizing the animals specifically because there are mitzvos that are relevant to those animals. And part of the message that we'll see and that we've seen previously is that Yaakov is emphasizing his connection to Kedusha. So therefore, that which has a connection to a mitzvah, that gets emphasized, and that which doesn't, doesn't. And the Nitziv points out also that these gifts, they're animals and they're diamonds, exclude, doesn't send him servants, excludes people who have das, who have independent will and consciousness, because that would have been a big detriment to them to be sent into the hands of Esav. So he was sensitive to that, and he didn't send him anything that would have come on anyone else's cheshbon. And that was also part of the consideration. Now, the whole role of gifts here is interesting. There's a drasha about this in the Sefer Mishkan Betzalel, the drasha of Betzalel Radinsky, where he raises a question. You know, at this point, do you really think that gifts are going to help? It's just going to remind Esav of how well he's doing, of how rich he is, which, again, harkens back to the first Aliyah, where he talks about, you shouldn't be so jealous of me, and he focuses on Imlava and Garti, and Rashi has that comment that this is a reflection on his continuing commitment to mitzvos, even in the context of Lavan. So what exactly is going on there? So he explains that it's not that this is supposed to win him over specifically because it's so appealing, but here he's fighting with his brother, and while we know sibling rivalry is clearly a thing, but to be able to do real harm one brother to the other, that only happens when affection has left the relationship, when all sense of brotherhood has dissipated. And therefore, he's trying to bring some reminders of their connection and trying to kind of revive that affection, and hoping that it would be this kind of a sympathy that would be generated. But at the same time, he's still creating some distance or emphasizing some distance by talking about Imlava and Garti, and Chazal also see her reference to Para Aduma, which really seems to be hard to understand. And he suggests that the whole point is that he is trying to still say that, yes, I want us to feel like brothers, and I want us to have recognition of our affection, and that we shouldn't want to hurt each other, but there's still going to be a distance because Lamaisa, I'm living a different kind of life and committed to a different set of values, and that is going to require a distance between us, but at the same time, we want there to be affection, and that's what this is supposed to try to bring about. So, okay, so the next few psukim, they detail this, so we'll skip ahead a little bit, because we have a lot to do. So, skip to after all the description of all of these gifts. So, let's go to Pasuk of Gimel, which really gets into some very heavy content, both what's expressed and what's not expressed. So, the Pasuk tells us, Vayokom balai lahu. So, he got up that night, Vayikach eshtei noshav, v'eshtei shivchosav. So, okay, there's the four wives. V'yasachar asar yelodav, and his 11 sons. V'yavar es Mavri Yabok, and he crossed over Mavri Yabok. So, here, there is a lot to try to figure out. Mavri Yabok here, this is a lot of symbolism, and what's happening here, Mavri Yabok has become kind of symbolic. It's kind of entered the lexicon like crossing the Rubicon. This idea of crossing, this dramatic crossing, has become evocative of crossing from one world to the next. There's a sefer called Mavri Yabok that's about indeed the transition from this world to the next world. So there's a lot of foreshadowing here. But it's also noted by Chazal in a very often quoted and very hard to understand comment, that if there are only 11 children that are listed here, so what happened to Dina? So Dina Heichan Haisa, where was Dina? So Chazal tell us, very hard idea to understand, that she was concealed, that Yaakov was hiding her from Esav, because he was afraid that maybe Esav would see her and want to marry her. And that's not the surprising part so much. The surprising part is that apparently that's considered to be a problem, and that's considered to be criticized because Esav loses out on this kira of opportunity. And that leads on some level to what happens with Dina and Shechem later on in the parsha. So that is so difficult to understand because, you know, a box or no box, whatever it is, but the idea of concealing Dina from Esav, that would seem to be a no-brainer. I mean, it's hard to imagine that anyone would say that if somebody has a daughter to marry off, that he should try to find the worst possible guy, because that way there's the most good that can be done, that maybe she'll have a hashpa on him. And the bigger a tzaddikas your daughter is, the more you should try to find the worst possible guy, because there you'll have the greatest potential impact. So I don't think anyone would advise that to any parent who's looking to find a shidduch for a child. I don't think anyone would question that Yaakov's protection of Dina is clearly the way to go. So the idea that he's criticized this is very, very difficult to understand. And as you could imagine, there are many comments about this. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, in his comments in the Sefer Emes LeYaakov, has a number of approaches. And maybe Esav actually did make more sense as a shidduch because of his overall family connections. Or maybe if we have an idea that Yaakov had wanted to create some kind of a Yisachar Zvulun partnership with Esav, that he would take care, Yaakov would take care of the Olam Haba issues, and Esav would take care of the Olam Hazeh issues. There are some who understand, there's a whole tradition about this, that's what Yitzchak had in mind with the Brachos. So then it must have been that he saw more potential in Esav than he's letting on. He also points out that there is an opinion in the Gemara at the end of the first parak of Bava Basra that Iov was alive at that time and who was not a Jewish person, and that he ended up marrying Dina, so it didn't seem that Yaakov was necessarily looking for a Ben Yeshiva for the Shidduch. And there are others who suggest, Tar Tamima has a comment along these lines, Rav Schechter often makes a similar point, that maybe there was what he could have done to really be successful here, and he just didn't have enough of a motivation to do so. He didn't feel like that was something he was really driven to do. You know, some raise the question, with Nayim Latar, and many others point out that we have a tradition from the previous parsha, that when the pasuk says that Einei Leah Rakos, that Leah had the weak eyes, it was because she had been crying so much because she knew what they were assuming, that Yitzchak had two sons and that Rachel and Leah were destined for the two sons, and that therefore Leah was going to marry Esav, and she was so upset about that that she was crying her eyes out. Literally, she made her eyes weak with all of her crying. So we don't find any criticism of her for that. So why is she called to task? Why is she not called to task and Yaakov is? So he has some suggestions there, those Nayim Latara, that maybe it was would have been harder for her because here Dina was a daughter of two tzaddikim and Leah wasn't. So therefore she wouldn't have necessarily had the same fortitude to be able to stand up against Esav, and it wouldn't have been the same kind of balance. But also, this is an important point we'll say a little bit more about, is that she didn't have the same achrayas for Esav that Yaakov did. Yaakov was his brother, and that's something that always plays a role. We have this notion of Sarchal Tethalim and other elements also, that there is a greater sense of responsibility here that Yaakov should have felt, and that's a part of the equation. So one approach to this issue, a very, very important idea which affects every aspect of life and comes up every day and is a crucially important notion to emphasize, is that Bali Mutsu suggests that there's a parallel question you could ask in Parshas Kisisa after the Chet HaEgel and after the Luchos are broken. So the Torah tells us that Kadosh Baruch Hu commands Moshe to set up the second set of luchos. He should make them himself. Psal luchos, shnei luchos avanim karishonim. That you should make the set of luchos. And the pasuk says, psal lucha. So Medrash has a comment that, yeah, you make these set of luchos because you should know how expensive luchos are. You should know what goes into making them. You just casually throw them off the side of a mountain. They don't grow on trees. It's a hard thing to make luchos. You should have to make the second set of luchos. And the Bali Musar asked there also, well, you're criticizing Moshe. Don't we have the Masoret, the last Rashi and Chumash, that what Moshe did was correct. That Moshe was right when he broke the luchos. So why is there this implicit criticism that, oh, you make the second set because you broke the first set? So the Bali Musar explained that it's the same answer to both questions, that Moshe did the right thing, and Yaakov did the right thing also in concealing Dina. But the criticism, the room for a taina, is that they should have felt bad about the loss. They should have recognized what the cost was of this decision. So the final ruling was the correct ruling, but it doesn't excuse you from feeling a sense of what was lost and what couldn't be. And that always has to be a part of it, and it cuts both ways. It means that when you have a difficult decision to make and that decision ends up hurting someone or costing someone else, so it doesn't mean that it's the wrong decision. It may be the necessary decision. But in both directions, it doesn't excuse us from feeling bad about what could have been or what had to be lost. And that feeling bad, which is appropriate, doesn't hold us back from doing what needs to be done. So that balance on both sides is still very important, and that's what's being highlighted here. In the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, it fits even more clearly, because the idea of you should make the luchos is not necessarily a criticism. It's just saying that you should just appreciate what goes into luchos. You should appreciate what the luchos represent. And even though the decision was correct, so here it's a little bit more, you have to read between the lines, but perhaps that's what's happening here also. And that is a very core message. And again, this comes up every day in life and on a national level. I make hard decisions, and it's crucial to be able to appreciate both halves of this equation. And perhaps that's a big part of what Chazal are conveying to us. There's more to say about this. We'll come back to this topic in a few minutes. But first, to look at what happens after this. So to read a little further, so the Kochem, Vayavire Mesanachal, the Averes Hashelo. So okay, so he took them and he crossed over the Nachal and he took what he had with him. Now here is this very dramatic pasuk, Vayivase Yaakov Levado, Vayavik Ishimo Adalos Hashachar. Surprise. Okay, so Yaakov is left alone and he gets into a struggle, he gets into a wrestling match with somebody, with some man, until Osa Shachar Omen. So here, as you can imagine, this is a loaded, packed pasuk, and there is so much that's conveyed here. So, Vayivase Yaakov Levado, so Rashi has a comment, why is it that he was left alone, considering that he had all those family members that were just described? So Rashi writes here, Shachach Pachim Kitanim V'Chazer Elein. So he forgot small containers, small jugs, and he went back to get them. Sounds very surprising on a number of levels. And there are some who suggest that these Pachim Kitanim are somehow connected through history to the Pach HaShemen that is on our minds right now, that as we anticipate Hanukkah next week, that Pach HaShemen is somehow reflected here, and that the ongoing Muhammad between the nations of Yaakov and of Esav is being referenced here, and that's something that we'll come back to as well. But further, it's also quoted in Rashi from the Gemara Maseches Chulin. The Gemara says, Mikan shetzadikim chasem amamonam shel yishluch yedehim begezel. So we see that tzadikim are careful about their money, that they don't want to be casual about letting their property get lost. And that sounds like a surprising idea, because that doesn't sound so Jacobian, right? It doesn't sound so Yaakov-like. Yaakov's such a tzaddik, and the idea that they're so materialistic, it's not what we would necessarily expect. What's hardest to understand is the way the Gemara also has the language, not quoted here in Mishrashi, but not only they care about their mamonam, but the yotzim megufam, that they care about them even more than their own selves. Many years ago, There was a comedian in America by the name of Jack Benny. And Jack Benny used to have a routine where he'd be approached by a mugger. And the mugger sticks out a gun and says, "Your money or your life?" And Jack Benny doesn't respond after a few seconds. So the mugger says, come on, your money or your life?" And Jack Benny responds, I'm thinking. So that line, presumably he got this from his ancestor and his namesake. The original Yaakov apparently had the same, the original Jack apparently had the same conflict that here, Yechasam al Mamonim Yosef Migufam, is not sure what should come first. He put his life at risk in order to protect his money. So what exactly is being conveyed here? This certainly is a surprising kind of attitude to attach Shavka to Tzadikim. So some understand, and as the Gemara already indicates, that this is because they're so careful not to steal. The Gemara has the language, Shlo Yishlichu Yidei and Begezel. They're so careful not to steal, so therefore their money takes on a different status. Rav David Feinstein, Zichrono Livracha, who is still mourning his recent passing, would emphasize this idea that the money, the property that the tzaddikim had, is testimony to their great care and to their great emuna and their great care in not stealing, and therefore everything they had is kind of an edus about them. You know, the stories they tell about him, about Rav David Feinstein, wouldn't eat breakfast on the cheshbon of the yeshiva because it wasn't in his contract. So in that case, people who are like that, who live lives like that, so their property says something about them. It represents the kind of values by which they live their lives. And so it's important to aid us. But there's also the idea that Rashid Karambiyavn, the Chon Lebrach, expanded upon this in a sefer, that everything in this world is good and bad. It has potential to do good. It has potential to do bad. And tzaddikim, they recognize that, and therefore everything that's in their possession represents potential. And you know, if l'mashal, if Chas v'Shalom, let's say a shulb is on fire, so everyone runs out. But we know people, if they can, shouldn't risk their lives for this. But they can, if they can, they always try to take out the Sifrei Torah and try to save the Sifrei Torah from the fire. So that doesn't surprise anyone. If somebody was very careful to make great effort to save the Sefer Torah from destruction, so that wouldn't seem so surprising. We'd understand that that's an item of great holiness, and therefore we want to preserve that. So if a tzaddik relates to everything he has that way, that all of his possessions are given to him because they are potential for Kedusha, so then it's also going to be something he's going to take very seriously, and he's not going to be casual about the Rashiv in that Sicha. He also spoke about how, you know, clearly all the Gashmias could be either good or bad, depending on how you relate to it, and he notes that Kavod is the same way. Kavod also could be either a tool to accomplish good things, or it could be a Yesahara. And this is the way that you can tell which one it is the person who is using it or who is holding on to it, so does he also want other people to have it? So especially, say, in the case of Kavod, so that Kavod can reflect some positive purpose, but if you want Kavod and you want other people not to have the Kavod, then it's hard to see that that is coming from any kind of a good place. But if you're makbid on the Kavod of other people and on your own Kavod, so then perhaps there is some legitimacy to the idea that you are seeing that as something productive and valuable, and that's the attitude of the tzaddik, and that's what's reflected here as well. So to also expand on that idea, you saw recently the Sefer came out in the past year called Sheish Mashzar, where the author, the announced theme of the Sefer on the cover, is that he, for every parsha, he discusses one theme that unites the whole parsha. And this week's parsha, in Parsha Vayishlach, so he has a nice discussion, which a lot of it happens to center around themes in this Aliyah, as well as in the larger parsha as a whole. And as far as the struggle, here the literal and the symbolic struggle as well, between Yaakov and Esav, and how it draws on the events of the past parshias also. So we know that Yaakov ended up getting the brachos from Esav, and the circumstances are complex and seem to be perhaps along the lines of what you might call an avera lishma, of actions that we wouldn't endorse in any other context, but are justified because of their motive and because of their great need. So when you have a situation like that, it's crucial that the motives have to be very pure and lishma, and really have to be justified by the need. So everything that we find in this parsha reflects this tension that Yaakov needs to establish for himself, and also for Esav, that the fact that he took the brachos from him, he did it for lishma purposes, he did it for preserving the spiritual future of Klal Yisrael, and not because of any side motive, not because it also comes with material benefits and it comes with riches and all of that. That was not something that he was focused on, and he suggests that explains a lot of what we read in the parasha. It explains why he's trying to appease Esav with property and why he's giving him so much. He's saying, this is not what's important to me. I'm happy to give that to you. He suggests even why what we found in last week's parasha, we spoke about also in Cheney, about how he gave Eliphaz all of his money, and that was his suggestion. It was also a part of a message. He's saying, this is not what I'm about. And he also suggests that what we just spoke about in the previous pasuk about the whole issue with Dina, and why Yaakov is held to task for that, is because if he really is trying to say that I'm about spirituality and I want a spiritual benefit, and that's why I had to take the brachos, so then the question of how concerned is he about Esav's spirituality also becomes a central question. So is he willing to really invest a lot of care and effort in trying to preserve Esau's spiritual potential, or does he not worry about that so much? So therefore, that becomes much more relevant to Yaakov because of this whole history. And he, in that context, he also addresses why it is, the question we mentioned a minute ago, why it is that Leah is not held to task for her desire not to marry Esau, while Yaakov is held responsible for not wanting Dina to marry Esav, because Leah doesn't have this whole obligation, she doesn't have this whole history. But we mentioned a minute ago about Yaakov being Esav's brother, but not just his brother, but one who has to establish that he really is focused on the value here of preserving the spirituality of both of them, and is not focusing on the monetary component. So that becomes a higher priority, and it becomes a greater level of sensitivity, and that's why that's a theme here as well. So here at this moment of confrontation, so this was really brought to the forefront, and he suggests, taking a slightly different path from the Chazal, that the idea that he went back for the Pachim Kitanim, which we just represented, why that's praiseworthy and why that's the behavior of a tzaddik. But that has to be established too, because one could take that as materialism, like we said before. One could take that as evidence that he cares very much about his property, and that's what he is prioritizing. So therefore, the Sarah Shalesa finds that moment to attack. Oh, here he is, he's vulnerable, because he is showing his materialism, and you see that's what he's about, so that's where Sarah Shalesov comes in and says, okay, you see, all of the brachos were just for that, and that was what you were going for. So that's where they struggle. But ultimately, Yaakov is victorious in this struggle. And when he is by himself, Ayuvasa Levado, he is able to ascertain what his true, correct motives are, and that he is true to himself. And that ultimately, that battle is what this all represents. It's a very fascinating perspective that does address some of these themes that we find throughout the parsha. So this idea of levado is one that Chazal has emphasized, and the Medrash actually compares Yaakov to God in this way, and says that the idea of levado, the Avasa Yaakov levado, is compared to a Veniska Hashem levado. That's just like God is alone, so Yaakov is also portrayed as being alone. And there's a drasha, another contemporary sefer called Uri V'Yishi, where he notes that this idea of highlighting levado as a praise of Yaakov that makes him comparable to the Ribono Shel Olam is also the theme that we find in Chanukah, of not necessarily levado, but ma'atim, of Rabban Biad Ma'atim, as being put in opposition to the masses, and that willingness to stand alone, and that willingness to cite much more numerous sources, is not only the miracle of Hanukkah, but it's the reason for Hanukkah. It's that ability to be able to be true to oneself and to recognize where you really are in those dark and lonely moments and who you really are in those dark and lonely moments. That's what is the source of success for Yaakov. And this is what the source of the success of Hanukkah is as well. And that's a big part of what we commemorate. And this idea of, after so much in every word in this pasuk, so after Vayivasa Yaakov Levado, so now Vayovek Yishimo, so now he has this struggle, he has this fight, and this represents, this is the war that he has. So the Mishonim understand this represents the struggle with the Yetzirah. And the Gemara says also there in Chulin that Avak Raglehem, that the dust of their feet, that went up to the Kiseh HaKavod. And Tarat Mima writes over there that that's a remez to the idea that the war is going to continue until the Kiseh of Hashem is Shalem, the Torah says in the context of the war with Amalek, the descendant of Esav. And this is a symbolism to this struggle that goes way beyond that moment. They recently published this year the drashos of Rav Shmuel Yitzchak Hillman, who was, if not mistaken, the father-in-law of Rav Herzog, of the chief rabbi, and he has a sefer Or HaYasher, which has a fascinating history behind it, which we should talk about a different time. But Or HaYasher, it's available in many volumes on basically called Torah Kula, and Chumash and Shas and the Rambam and everything else. And so they published this year's drashos on Bereishis. So he notes here that this whole symbolism of the dust going up to Kiseh HaKavod is a way of saying that this is not just a battle between these two individuals, but it's a battle that's symbolic of what goes on for many generations. And even though Yaakov is able to prevail, the individual, but there is an impact throughout history. And he suggests the idea of an injury to his leg represents that which hampers one from being able to walk forward, being able to advance. And indeed, the idea that we find Skatnas Hadoros among the Jewish people, in contrast to with Esav, he says, if you would compare a descendant of Esav who's alive today to the original Esav, it would seem like the descendant is probably far, far more advanced than his ancestor. While if you'd compare a descendant of Yaakov to Yaakov himself, so Yaakov would clearly be on a much higher level, because we have this whole idea of Hiskatnas Hadoros, of how generations farther removed are not in the same Madrega, but that's not where we want to be. We want to constantly be growing, but that's where the struggle holds us back. And he went on to talk about some of the issues that was relevant to his situation in terms of supporting yeshivas and in terms of Talmud Torah, and how our ongoing battle has held us back and has left us with somewhat of an injury that needs to be addressed. The Litzkarov, the Yoznayim Latorah, also has another comment here, that one of the points that is being conveyed here, the Kodesh Baruch Hu was telling him that Yaakov can't rely either on his personal strength or on his wealth. That you see that if we assume that the Pachim Ketanim represent a focus on his wealth and got him in trouble, so you see that that was not going to protect him. And also his physical strength didn't prevent him from being ambushed. Only Kodesh Baruch Hu could do that. So all of that highlights his the connection here and the importance of these continuing themes. The idea of this ish that Pasuk is referring to, so the Kliyakar tells us that that is Samael, that is Yetzahara, the Satan, the Malach HaMavet, the one who blinds your eyes to the truth. Shaul Salanter understood that it's the idea of the Koach HaDimyon, that it's that which creates an illusion, and therefore we get pulled in by short-term values because we're not able to see clearly. It's evocative of the idea of the Beis HaLevi. The Beis HaLevi notes that the Gemara says in the Maseches Sukkah that in the future, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to shecht the Yetzirah, and the Yetzirah is going to appear to the Tzadikim like a mountain, and to the Rishayim it's going to look like a hare. And the Tzadikim are going to cry. They're going to say, wow, how was it that we were able to overcome this mountain, that we were able to climb over such an obstacle? And the Rishayim, who see it just as a hare, they're going to say, how is it that we were not able to overcome that? It was such a nothing. How is it that we fell to the Yetzer Hara? And the Beis HaLevi explained that really it's the same thing. It's that the Yetzer Hara is built up by the Koach HaDimyon, by this idea of the power of illusion, that we tend to inflate in our minds that which we desire, and it becomes much bigger than it really is. So the Tzadikim, who never gave in to the Yetzer Hara, so it keeps looking bigger and bigger, it keeps looking like it's something that's so amazing, and they are nispoiled that they were able to overcome it. While the Rishayim, who did give into it, and they did find out what it was all about, so they saw that it was nothing. They saw that it wasn't something that they really should have fallen prey to, and that's where they end up getting so sad and so disdainful, and so in such despair. So Vayar kilo yocholo, Vayiga b'kaf yirecho, v'teka kaf yirech Yaakov behavik imo. So he saw that he wasn't able to overcome him, so he ends up hitting him in his thigh as they are in the middle of this whole wrestling. Vayomer shalcheini ki olah hashachar, so he says to him, please let me go because it's now already the morning. Vayomer lo hashalechecha ki imbrechtani. So Yaakov says, I'm not going to let you go unless you give me a bracha. And as Rashi says, Hodili Ahabracha Shibrachani Avish Aisub Mara Lehen, that here you have this idea which now we see is consistent with what a lot of the Darshanim have been saying about what's going on here, that this goes to the essence of the battle that was centered around the brachos and about the legitimacy of the process. Does Yaakov really deserve the brachos? And does Esav acknowledge that he deserves them? So therefore, if this wrestling match has taken a symbolic of that, and then as a conclusion to it, so Yaakov says, now you have to bless me, I want you to acknowledge that I'm ready for the brachos, acknowledge that what happened was necessary and appropriate. So it says, Vayomer Elov, Mashmecha, Vayomer Yaakov. So he says, okay, so what's your name? And he says that my name is Yaakov. So he says back to him, he says, Vayomer, Lo Yaakov Yamer Od Shimcha, your name is not going to be Yaakov anymore, Kiyam Yisrael, your name is now Yisrael, Ki Sarisa, Im Elokim, Yimanoshim, Vatuchal. Because here you have wrestled with God and with people, and you have prevailed, you have been able to survive. Vayishal Yaakov Ayomer, Hagidun HaShemecha, so Yaakov says, tell me your name, Vayomer, Lamazet, Yishal Hashmi, Varechos Hashem, says, don't ask, it doesn't matter. Perfect for this whole mysterious, dramatic episode. It's mamish written with such dramatic tensions. Okay, it doesn't matter who I am, but he gives him the bracha. So here, this idea that he is called Yisrael now instead of Yaakov, and the pasuk says that you're not going to anymore be called Yaakov. So here, the Gemara, the end of the first part of Brachos, addresses this, that we need to understand it a little bit, because we have a similar language by Avram, that Avram used to be Avram, and now he was renamed Avram, and the Pasuk says he's now Avram only and not Avram, and the Gemara says in the end of the first parak of Brachos, that HaKore LaAvram Avram over Basay, that somebody who refers to Avram as Avram is in violation of this din. It's like it's a positive mitzvah. So there's a big discussion in some svarim. Is that really true? We don't see that really coming up halacha. We don't see it being invoked halacha. So what exactly does that mean? But one way or another, as the Gemara indicates, there is still a difference between Avraham and Yaakov and Yisrael, in that when it comes to Avraham, it's an absolute change, whether that's there's an assay involved or not, but it still clearly becomes his name completely and totally afterwards. And when it comes to Yaakov, we don't find that Kpeda, as indicated by the fact that I've been referring to him the whole day as Yaakov and not as Yisrael. So we continue to refer to him as both. So that's a topic of a much commentary. The Stipler, whose name was appropriately Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky, so he called himself by both names. So the Stipler in his Sefer HaNechumish in the Berkus Peretz, so he explains a little bit the difference that in the case of Avram, so Avram became Avraham, he was Av Hamon Goyim, he became the ancestor of a great nation and of many people. So that's completely a new identity, and that overtakes his old identity. But in the case of Yaakov and Yisrael, so it's not that he's actually taking on a whole different identity, that there's a different emphasis here, that Yaakov is the name of Katnus, and others point out the idea that he was holding on to the heel of his brother, so that itself seems to indicate some kind of dependency, while Yisrael is the name of greatness, is the name of being able to conquer. So the way the Stipler understands it is that Yisrael is that he defeats enemies, but there's still going to be more enemies to defeat. It's not like it's a done deal. So this is an ongoing issue. While Avram's status as the ancestor of the Jewish people, so that's a permanent change, and that is something that is a constant, while Yaakov is in an ongoing struggle. So he wins, and then he has to fight another day. So it's not Yisrael completely replacing Yaakov. But in addition to that, the Maram Shik, they published many years ago already from the Tshuvas and the Drashas of the Maram Shik. So they took from there and they made Sfarim al HaTorah and a Sefer on Pirkei Avos. Maram Shik was one of the great students of the Chacham Sofer. So the Maram Shik in his Drashas, so he notes along these lines also that the idea of the difference between Yaakov and Yisrael, like we said a minute ago, that Yaakov is a name of Katnus in a sense, and Yisrael is a name of glory, and is a name of majesty, and especially if you add to it this idea of Yaakov holding on to the heel and being dependent, while here Yisrael, he's the victor, and that's the imagery. So yes, that is a part of his identity, but you have to still be connected to your roots. You have to still, even as you step up to the big time, you have to still remember where you came from. And the idea of the angel of Esav, of the Sutton, who is taking him over here, is trying to take him over, is trying to defeat him. So he's actually trying to instill within him Gaiva. And especially if you imagine it that way, right? So here, he just lost to him, right? So what's the Sutton's last move after he loses? Okay, so fine, so you won, so now I'll try to lull you into a false sense of security. I'll try to let it go to your head. So you must be fantastic, you're great, you are only Yisrael. You are only the one who wrestles with God and with people and who wins, and you should be pretty happy with yourself. And Yaakov himself, he realizes that, no, okay, so it's important to acknowledge that he's able to overcome in this context, but it's not something that he should let get to his head. It's not something that should define him totally. He has to still remain connected to his roots, to his Yaakov. You still have to be able to talk to people. You still have to be able to be nice to everyone and not think that you're separate from everyone. By Eliezer Geldseller, Zetzal, who was a great Rosh Yeshiva who died young in an accident, and he published some drushes from him. The very beautiful drushes reveal a lot about his personality. He was a member of my extended family, and he has a drusha there where he emphasizes how, you know, even when you're great, you still have to be able to remember all the people who you knew before and still be able to talk to everyone and shake everyone's hand and remember your connection to everyone else. You can't let that get to your head. And that's perhaps what the Sarah Shalisov was trying to contradict, was trying to tell Yaakov, okay, now you're purely Yisrael, but Lamaisa, that's not how we relate to it. We relate to him as Yisrael and Yaakov. So, as we said, the disciple uses both names, but why don't we find that Yaakov's just addressed by both names? Why don't we find that he's referred to as Yaakov Yisrael? So, here, it's interesting that you don't find that really anywhere in the Torah, right? You don't find people, for the most part, with two names. And that's more of a modern phenomenon. And the Chassam Sofer has a tshuva about this, where he writes also that the tradition is to give one name. And he quotes a story that's quoted in many places that Marshal brings in his Yamshel Shlomo Shel Gittin. Yamshel Shlomo on Gittin. Yamshel Shlomo Sech of Gittin. The Marshal brings the story about the history of the name Shner. Shner is now a name particularly popular among Lubavitchers because it was the name of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Shner Zalman. But not only Lubavitchers, Rashi Lake was also named Shner. So that name, where does Shner come from? So the Marshal says that there was a disagreement once between two parents, a mother and father who had a baby boy, and the one of them wanted to name the baby Meir, and the other one wanted to name the baby Uri. So they came to the Rav and they said, what should we do? You know, so, who wins here? Does he get named Meir? Does he get named Uri? So the Rav of the town told them that, why don't you name him Shner? Because Shnei Ur, that will combine these two ideas. Meir is about light, and Uri is about light. So very appropriate for Hanukkah, and so we're trying to bring in as many lights as possible. So why don't you name him Shner? So that's the history of the name Shner. So why does he have to be so creative? Why didn't they just name him Meir Uri? So Chassam Sofer says, you see here that they didn't have a tradition of using two names. They only had to pick one name. They couldn't have two names. Now, clearly, nowadays, we find that many do use two names, and the biggest kasha of all, if Chassam Sofer is asserting this position, so we should ask his son, the Ksav Sofer, about this, because his name was Avraham Shmuel Binyamin Sofer, three names, and he was named by them, Chassam Sofer, presumably. So I have to figure out exactly how that translates into contemporary practice. But that's just a tidbit about that aspect of the name change of Yaakov. So there's still a lot more to say about this aliyah. We won't be able to say it all, but part of what is brought up in the next aliyah, drawing from this incident, is the prohibition of the Gid Hanasha. And that prohibition is based on what just happened here, the idea that he is injured in his thigh, and therefore, pursuant to that, the Pasuk tells us that there is a prohibition for his descendants to eat the Gid Hanasha. It's a very mysterious prohibition, because how exactly does that connect to this, and how exactly is the Torah conveying its message specifically here? What exactly is the takeaway message from this? And in some ways, it seems like a direct contradiction to Hanukkah. In what ways? I'm being deliberately mysterious because, God willing, I plan on discussing this on Shabbos a little bit for those who are able to be in Yeshiva for Shabbos, and too long of a discussion to have now anyway. So both for timing considerations and to provoke your appetite for those who will be able to be with us over Shabbos, we'll talk about it then. Otherwise, we'll find other opportunities too. But there's quite a lot to say about this whole notion of how the Gid Hanasha prohibition reflects some of the themes of this aliyah. So God willing, whether it's this Shabbos or some other time, we will take the opportunities that we can to try to develop that further. But until then, whether I'll get to see you or not, I wish you a wonderful Shabbos. It should be only good things. We should be inspired by the light that Yaakov fought to preserve and that we anticipate in the upcoming Hanukkah season. And it should be a source of bracha and safety and inspiration for all of us. Okay, have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hold on.